I guess I see one Kleenex box here. I'm sorry that Friday I wasn't able to make it, although I have to say that the fact that I was able to finish my lecture on Thursday was in itself semi-miraculous. I was, however, very pleased to see what you did on Friday, because I think actually you made good progress with the guidance of Dennis, and having you actually work through some of this BCS stuff is probably much more efficient in terms of your learning than having me work it out on the blackboard. Having said that, let me just say what the strategy is from here on. Today, I am going to try to work through some more of this BCS theory up to a point where there will then be an exercise that you can all do in the tutorial. Okay, and I think that will actually provide the right balance between listening and doing. I should also say that having done that, that will be sort of the end of the formal presentation on BCS theory, although there's an enormous amount that one could do, more than one could do. But what my plan then for the rest of the week is that I will be lecturing Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday on, if you like, things that are relevant to high-temperature superconductivity. Again, another vast subject where I can only pick a few little concepts or ideas which hopefully will be integrated into what we've done up till then. Dennis, I have to attend the Board of Governors meeting of McMaster on Thursday. Dennis is going to put something together on Ginsburg-Landau theory, which is really absolutely central approach to the theory of superconductivity and related to other subjects that you've learned about and which are of interest to you. So that's the plan. Hopefully by the end of the week, what I'd like to achieve is that you could have a little bit of an understanding or a glimpse of the reasons why superconductivity theory has emerged as an important theoretical subject. Which has attracted the attention of basically the majority of condensed matter physicists, certainly the ones in electron physics. Okay, so let's now go back to where we were. We studied this trial or variational quadratic Hamiltonian, which incorporates into it the possibility of pairing of electrons, of constructing a ground state in which the electrons are paired with some amplitude given by these deltas. And but this is, as I think I'm sure I said in the last time I was here, that this is just another quadratic Hamiltonian, and you know how to solve any quadratic Hamiltonian, whether it's classical or Bose or Fermi operators, whatever. You can diagonalize it exactly. And you find, in the case of fermions, there'll be a ground state and then some excitations. And in particular, you diagonalized it with this unitary transformation from the electron operators to these quasi-particle operators which create or destroy excitations from the ground state of the system. And when you worked through this, what you found was that, might as well draw it here. Although you might not have expressed it exactly this way, was 1/2 times 1 minus And uk squared was basically the same thing with the plus sign. So these functions look like this. Versus, if you plot them versus, well, let's put it this way. Let's call this mu, and then we can plot them versus this parameter, epsilon v. Basically, v squared does this. Let's put in a half here so I can have a little reference point. And uk squared looks like this. Okay, so vk squared is one for these are the variational energies that are like the kinetic energies less than mu or EF, and u squared is just the complement of that. They add up to one. And 2uk vk, just the modulus, is just delta k over the same thing. And so this looks more like a peak. And its width is 2 delta. So that's what those functions look like. And then I don't think you did this, but if you take having solved for u and v explicitly in terms of the parameters in the variational Hamiltonian, if you then substitute then that in here and go back and put that in here and calculate what the Hamiltonian is in terms of the gamma operators, the excitation operators, what you find about write this in a certain way, sum over k. How do I want to write this? Looks good. So what is this? So that's what you get. This is this using this with the particular u's and v's that diagonalize in the sense that there are no terms in this Hamiltonian of the form gamma dagger. You worked through all that. And this first term here, which doesn't depend on the quasi-particle operators, is the ground state energy. If you like, the vacuum of these gammas has energy this. So you can call this E naught of delta. It's the ground state energy of the system when the gap has a certain size. Yeah.
Is the ground state of the gammas the same?
Is the vacuum of the gammas is?
Is not the same as the one for the Cs.
Oh, definitely not. If I understand your question, the vacuum.
The vacuums are different.
The vacuum. What do you mean by the vacuum for the Cs?
Well, something that would be killed by.
Yeah, I mean, which means no electrons.
Yeah. Oh, okay, right.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
So the C's are particles and gammas are
nothing. Yeah, so these C's, I mean, yeah, these, let me put it this way. There's the real Hamiltonian, which we haven't looked at yet, which has kinetic energy and potential energy of real electrons. And that is a function of the C's, which create and destroy electrons. There's this variational Hamiltonian, which is fake, but it is also written in terms of the operators which create and destroy electrons. The question is, ultimately the question is, what's the best variational wave function to define an approximate ground state or free energy for the real Hamiltonian? An intermediate question is, what's the exact solution for this fake Hamiltonian, okay, and that's which we're going to then use to calculate expectation values. And, so the exact solution is this. And if you like, this is the ground state energy, is the lowest energy state corresponding to that Hamiltonian. So we've solved that problem exactly. And the other thing, so what did I want to just point out about this? Yeah, so yeah, just to make sure that your intuition is here, and that you're with me, which I'm sure you guys are probably ahead of me. But so if you look at the terms in this sum, if this epsilon is less than mu, then this term's negative, which means this is positive, and this term is always positive. So you get a positive result. Okay? If this epsilon is greater than mu, then these two terms are canceling. In the limit where delta is zero, okay, what's the value of this E naught when delta is zero? No, not at all. It's the difference between the absolute value and x itself. Okay. So, I mean, just to put it in words or to make a picture, if delta is zero, then basically these two terms add for states with energies less than mu, or for things below the Fermi energy, and they add and give you a 2. Okay? Whereas for states above the Fermi energy or above the chemical potential, they cancel exactly and give you 0. So the energy, when delta equals 0, is exactly the energy of the filled Fermi sphere where it's filled with both up spin and down spin electrons. That's where the T comes from. Okay? So that's what the ground state energy is. So you can see then that if you start from the ground state energy of the filled Fermi C, and then you gradually turn on this delta, you're going to get a little bit extra lowering of the energy. Okay? Because you're making this thing, which is a positive definite quantity, bigger. And there's a minus sign out front. So that tells you that opening up the gap for this system lowers the ground state energy. So I guess the only question is, yeah, but how big should it be? Okay, and that's not addressed in this problem, because delta appears at the beginning, and appears at the end, and so delta can be whatever you want. Okay. So now we want to do this problem, which is that we want to take these wave functions, which are the eigenstates, or take these states, which are the eigenstates of the fake or variational Hamiltonian, and use them to calculate a free energy of the real Hamiltonian. Okay, so by free energy, I mean basically use these states to calculate a thermal expectation value of the real Hamiltonian minus T times an entropy term, where the entropy term is the entropy which is appropriate for these quasi-particles. And that entropy will be the standard entropy of non-interacting fermions. Okay, so that's the strategy. Do you have any questions about that strategy? Okay, but it is exactly what we did before in the case of Archie Fock, which is a much simpler problem. Okay, so we define so now I've got to start using a slightly less cumbersome notation. Okay, so we just define these F. They're going to be in the entropy part, and then the free energy. Let's call it this time. I can't remember what we called it last time. Omega B. This is epsilon B. Okay. The attractive interaction. Well, actually, I put the minus sign out in front, so minus D is the attractive interaction. What do I want here? Q alpha minus Q theta. Plus T sum over K alpha So that's it. And all of these All of these expectation values are with respect to this variational Hamiltonian, which I had up here. So, so at this point, we can use Wick's theorem as before for the average of four operators, just as we did our only there's more of them. Well, actually, let me just remind you. This is the same thing. So when we use Wick's theorem, we got these terms. I have a 2 here, sorry. Might as well put it in, because I'm going to be carrying it along. So remember, we got a term like this. And that's what gave us our Hartree-Fock corrections to the single electron energies. OK? There's the Fock term, which is the interaction with the average density, corresponds to the average density of electrons interacting with each other. And this thing here is the exchange correction. And OK, so however, here, we have other non-zero averages. And so we get this extra term. And then there's the other term, which I'll just call minus TS, which is this. What's that? Yeah, because minus alpha. Yeah, it's yeah. Oh, sorry, here. Yeah.
Minus alpha.
Yeah,
they're the spin reversed. K and spin are reversed.
OK, so the point is, we know how to do all of these averages and get a result in terms of the parameters in the Hamiltonian. Now, in fact, so we know is equal to, if you just put in the expressions for the C's in terms of the gammas, and you know that the expectation value of the product of two gammas is going to be 0 unless it's gamma dagger gamma or gamma gamma dagger. So it's some number conserved. The number of these quasi-particles is conserved. And you know what the U's and the V's are. And so I won't work through all the algebra. But what you find is that this is equal to that's just some algebra, which I can't remember whether it's something that you would have already done, but it's straightforward. And similarly, one of these is equal to delta k times fk minus a half over ck. And then there's exactly the same result for except for a complex conjugation. I guess you more or less had to do that. Okay, so now what have we got here? We want to minimize this free energy with respect to delta and epsilon. And we know that delta and epsilon also appear here inside the square root, and that this thing here appears in the f's in some exponential. So in principle, we can take the functional derivative of this thing with respect to epsilon v and delta, get two equations. And those will give us the self-consistent equations for epsilon and delta. OK? Probably it's fine to do that. I don't know. I've just never tried doing it that way. For some reason, when I get to this point, I feel compulsively like what I'd rather do is just do a functional derivative with respect to each of these averages, and maybe with respect to the f's, and then get something it would be easier to do that functional derivative. So that would be corresponding to taking functional derivatives with respect to this, which is just a complex conjugate of that, and the f's. Now, and that's easy to do, because each one of those functions appears in a simple way, like this just products. And this is just some logarithms, which, as we've seen, behave very nicely. Okay. The only problem with doing that is that, as you can see from here, these averages are not all independent of each other, because we've managed to write all the averages in terms of the, basically, they're not all independent, obviously, because you've got these relationships. Okay, So I don't know whether to apologize at this point for doing things this way or there's a remote chance that this is a clever way of doing it. I don't know. But you can. But the way that you deal with that, when you want to minimize with respect to a number of functions, but the functions themselves are not independent of each other, they're connected by some relation. First of all, you want to write down what is the relation. And then secondly, you can use that with the help of a Lagrange multiplier to sort of enhance the thing that you're minimizing. And that allows you to then differentiate in this easy way. Okay, so let me just sketch out how I actually do this. And sometime, you know, maybe you'll think, gee, that was either a good way of doing it, or you might think, why did he do that? I can do this in two steps just directly. I don't know. Okay, so the relationship you can easily see okay, so what have I done here? Okay, so first of all, if you look at this first one, and if you subtract off the half, you get something that goes like f minus a half. Square that, and then add it to half the square of this plus half the square of this. Everything has the same denominator, and the numerators all add up to cancel the denominator, because remember, c squared is epsilon minus mu squared plus delta squared, so it all cancels out. And you're just left with the common factor of f minus a half, which is this. And so basically what the relationship is, if you ignore the last step, is that this plus this plus this equals this. But the way I've written it is this plus this plus this minus this is 0. And I give 0 a name, which is f. Okay. And so basically, what I can do is I can add. These things are always done with a minus sign. Maybe somebody can tell me why. I can add this term, which involves a bunch of Lagrange multipliers multiplying the f's. And then in the standard Lagrange multiplier strategy, at the end, so you're going to do unrestricted differentiations with respect to the averages and the f's. And at the end, in principle, you adjust all these Lagrange multipliers so that the condition that all of the f's equal 0 is satisfied, or the conditions are satisfied. So that's the standard Lagrange multiplier strategy. And somehow, and everybody knows that, right? Yeah, that's OK. And somehow, it always seems like you never actually have to do that last step, because it comes out automatically. Sometimes you do. OK. So. Let's now do this. Now, I don't actually know if I should do all of these derivatives. Let's just start out with the easiest one and see how it works. You can see that these Fs only appear here in the entropy, and they also appear here in these Fs. Okay, so if you take, I should have, okay, so normally you give this another name after you add the extra term to it, but I didn't for to save us writing. So let's just carry along the name. Oh, I see, I can just call it. Call it that. So what do you get? You get the thing that you get from the entropy, which is just 2t log fk over 1 minus fk. And then let me just look. Yeah, okay, that's right. So back in the definition of the big F, it only had the little f's appearing as f minus a half squared. So then you get minus and if you're following, yeah. You think it's plus? Yeah, let me think. You might be right. Hold on. No, because it was minus, minus. Wait, OK, I see what you're saying. So there's a minus from that, and there's a minus from that. So that's probably OK, let me just make sure. The big F has minus fk minus a half squared in it, as you say. But it's minus F, so that makes it a plus. I think you're right. Gee, I hope that doesn't mess anything up. F over 1 minus F, dum 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 dum. And so then this would give, okay. So this would then give that lambda k is equal to, so in here we basically get beta c. And so we get minus O. OK, so what is this? This is 1 over e to the beta c plus 1 divided by 1 minus that, which is e to the beta c over e to the beta c plus 1. These guys cancel. It goes like e to the minus. So this picks up a minus sign. OK, so this thing here is minus 2, check me on this, ck. OK, great. I found the other minus sign. Okay. A little bit worried about the rest of the calculation. Yeah, it'd be terrible if self-consistent equations were inconsistent. OK, so lambda k is equal to, it was, uh, C K over 2F K minus 1, okay? So the twos, one of the twos cancels, the F comes over to the other side. This, we set this whole thing equal to 0. So the minus sign comes over, and this complicated quantity we set is that, and so that's what lambda is. Okay.
Did we lose the index alpha?
Oh, that went into the twos.
So both
the F itself. Yeah, yeah, you know. This sum here, if it, you could put an alpha index on the f's, but it doesn't really depend on alpha, and so this sum over alpha is really just a 2, and you can then just do it this way. I think that it doesn't lead to any complications, pretty sure. Okay, so. Similarly, let's see, how are we doing here? Yes. So I'm sort of hesitating as to how much more of this algebra to do. Let me sort of be succinct here. The next thing that we want to do is we want to take the variation with respect to C dagger K alpha, C K alpha. And what you're going to get there is exactly what you got for the Hartree-Fock part, because remember this just appears in those Hartree-Fock-like terms. So you're going to get epsilon v of k minus mu minus 1 over n this whole thing. And then you're going to get some other piece that comes from here, which I'll just say is minus lambda k alpha minus a half, which is, well, we don't have it here anymore, but the F had something squared with something like this squared. Okay. And and according to my notes, this whole thing is equal to minus wait, actually, according to my notes, it's not equal to that. The two came away. Where? Which two? Yes.
In fact, I just did on it, sorry.
Okay, so when you put in what lambda is, and when you put in what this is, and you cancel everything out, you get a factor of... Oh, I see. I see. I made one big mistake here. One big mistake. Okay. And the big mistake that I made was this. Okay? So we're taking the derivative of the expectation value of the real Hamiltonian. It contains the real kinetic energy. So it's that. I see, and so I have it wrong here, too. Okay, and so also important to correct that. This thing is the expectation value of the real Hamiltonian. The real Hamiltonian has the real kinetic energy. Not some variational kinetic energy. Okay, so when you look at your real Hamiltonian, it was kinetic energy plus potential energy. And so that was just the real kinetic energy. This thing here, this average, depends implicitly on the variational kinetic energy. But the thing that's multiplying it is the real kinetic energy. Maybe that actually, okay, well, let's just go to the next step, because then that might make more sense. Okay, because otherwise you might have looked at this and said, oh, great, okay. This cancels that, and so the kinetic energy disappears from the problem. And by the way, this whole thing is equal to zero when you know it. Whereas what we actually get is that this thing which we're looking for, we put on the other side of the equal sign. And that's equal to so I don't know if you can read this, but what it says is when you do this variation, set it equal to zero, you find that this variational function, epsilon v minus mu, is equal to the original kinetic energy in the starting problem, corrected by the Hartree-Fock corrections, a Hartree-Fock like correction to the self-energy of a single particle. Okay. So this is the kind of thing that we're looking for. We have these variational parameters. We've got epsilon of v and delta. We want to find out what value of these variational parameters or functions minimizes the free energy that involves the expectation value of the real Hamiltonian. So the variational parameter that does that will be expressed in terms of the parameters of the original Hamiltonian. except for the fact that it has this average on the right. So we haven't gotten to the end here. Okay. So let's actually then go ahead and put in the last step, because we know what this average is in terms of epsilon, v, and delta. So let me just say that. Then what we get is okay, so now you can see that you have a self-consistent equation for this variational kinetic energy in terms of itself, the known interaction potential, and buried in these Fs and Cs is the gap, which is also a function of K. So the point is we need one more equation. In other words, we need to calculate the variational derivative with respect to, for instance, that average, which is, by the way, often called an anomalous average because it's always zero if you consider particle number, of this thing. Okay, and here I won't go through the algebra. But it's exactly the same kind of thing. And what you get is that delta K just a second, let me check my minus signs here. Well, I assume that I've got this right. Okay. So I think it's because this thing is negative or something like that. It's the minus sign. Okay, so now we're set because we have two coupled self-consistent equations for the variational parameter of the gap, the variational kinetic energy, which we can solve simultaneously, and the only thing it depends on is the real kinetic energy and the real potential. So numerically, this is something you just go ahead and do. Okay. So that's, you can do that in the tutorial. Okay, bring lots of paper.
Okay, actually, Dennis will show you exactly. I mean, what can I say? Obviously, this is
a serious calculation for a non-trivial potential. And there's a number of approximations that you can make. And this always happens in mean field theory. And one thing you can do is you can really ignore the Hartree-Fock corrections, the kinetic energy. You don't know what your epsilon is to start with anyway. So you can just make some approximate form for the kinetic energy that you can manage. It's going to turn into like a density of states at the Fermi energy. The and then here, you're going to make the approximation that BCS always makes. And the approximation that BCS always makes, actually, this V isn't a function of K minus K prime. It's actually just a constant if the kinetic energy of particle with wave vector K is within the cutoff of the Fermi energy, and the same thing is true for the kinetic energy of the particle K prime. And otherwise, it's zero. And so calculations involving that potential quickly become very simple. So basically, and then, as we always do when we get to the end here, these sums over k's are going to get turned into energy integrals with respect to the Fermi energy times densities of states. And the fact that for weak coupling BCS, the gap is so small that the density of states that comes from either one of these doesn't vary in that range of energy means that the density of states is effectively a constant that you can take out of your integrals. So in the end, you'll get some integral, which I think you still can't do. Is that right? Or maybe one you can do. Well, no, one you can do and one you can't do. You can calculate the gap at t equals 0 exactly, I think. If you want to calculate the transition temperature where the gap goes to 0, I think there's an integral that you can't do. But anyway, you can work it out. Okay. So basically, it is actually possible to solve these equations in a meaningful way. I would say that computationally, when people do this type of calculation numerically, like on a lattice with putting in a model Hamiltonian and model parameters, you do in fact end up, you know, for say a two-dimensional system with n squared sites, you do end up with this huge number of self-consistent calculations that you solve numerically inside of a computer. And that's, you know, and that works. That's fine. So okay. So I think that's a good place to stop. See you guys tomorrow. Okay.